Well, our readings today challenge the wealthy to see and use their wealth in the light of what God demands, rather than simply following the normal ways of the world. The background here is the biblical conviction that the God of Israel is a God of justice and compassion, concerned for the oppressed and hungry, the orphan and the widow, all those who are most vulnerable, most likely to be forgotten and trodden underfoot. So we start from what God is like and what God asks of us, because God calls us to be channels of his justice and compassion in the world. We are to show the world what God is like. This is our solemn calling as God's people. And if we ignore it, we come under God's judgment. We hear this message from the prophet Amos, who so fiercely condemns those who are at ease in Zion. People sleeping in luxurious beds, eating and drinking fine food and wine, listening to pleasant music, wearing expensive perfume. So what are these people doing wrong? The point is that they are in Zion. They are members of the people of Israel. They should know what God is like and what God expects of them. Amos's criticism is that these people have many good things, but crucially, they are not grieved over the ruin of Joseph. Those living nearby, members of the tribe of Joseph, are in dire need. Their lives are in ruins, but the people criticized by Amos just don't care. Their wealth has sealed their hearts. The suffering of others doesn't touch them. There's nothing wrong per se with their wealth. The problem is what they have let their wealth do to their souls, their capacity for compassion, their sense of justice. And so Amos says, alas for them. And the message is strikingly very much the same in the story Jesus tells centuries later about a rich man who has everything, but his moral sense has died. He takes no notice of his neighbor Lazarus, starving at his gate with dogs licking his sores. This rich man, too, is not grieved by the suffering of his neighbor. He has gained the whole world and lost his soul. So alas for him. Am I becoming like that rich man? Is that where my life is headed? In both cases, the wealthy are not judged because they are wealthy, but because their wealth strangled their hearts and they ignored those in need. They are judged not for what they did, but for what they did not do. They did not show justice and compassion to those in need around them. Well, so if that's how Amos and Jesus addressed the people of their day, what do we make of the same challenge today? Well, one problem I think we face today is information overload. The complacent wealthy of Amos's time, they knew about the suffering of their neighbors in the tribe of Joseph. But we hear about the sufferings of the whole world and all the time. As well as the images on our screens, we get all those letters from charities telling heartrending stories. How can we respond to them all? If our hearts are open to the needs of others, does it mean we should never plan a holiday, buy concert tickets, or even enjoy modest luxuries like a glass of wine or a box of chocolates? And it's indeed a good question, because such things are luxuries. We do not need them. Out of obedience to Christ, what should we do? Should we be choice of radical simplicity. After all, Paul tells us that if we have food and clothing, we should be content with that. Let's remember, before we shrug off that challenge too quickly, that the church honours those Christians who have followed precisely this path. For example, St. Anthony, a wealthy young man in 3rd century Egypt, heard the words of Jesus to the rich young ruler, "Go, sell everything, and follow me." Anthony did just that. So did St. Francis centuries later in Italy, and many others down the ages. Even if we don't follow their example, and I clearly haven't, such Christians should at least remind us of our need to remain detached from our possessions. Anthony, Francis, and others demonstrate the beauty of a simple, uncluttered life. They warn us of the real spiritual danger there is in wealth. There is great wisdom in their way of life, however strange it may seem to the world. But most Christians, myself included, do not live like Anthony or Francis. We live in a world of work, salaries, medical insurance, mortgages and other bills to be paid, pensions, families to support, holidays to plan. And it's in this complicated, money-focused world that we have to work out what it means to live as faithful followers of Christ. Let's consider some principles to guide us. I think a very important part of our response to this challenge is to keep a global perspective. As Christians, we shouldn't see ourselves and assess our way of life only in terms of our immediate context here in Switzerland. We belong to the worldwide body of Christ, quite apart from the wider human family. And I'm so grateful that in various ways we are regularly reminded here at St. Ursula's of the global body of Christ perspective, which brings us joy and enrichment, but also challenge. We must also recognize that the challenges around wealth and poverty in today's world don't just come to us as individuals. We must think about it as individuals. I'll say more about that in a moment. But these challenges come to the church as an institution, to the Church of England and other churches. They come to governments. They come to businesses. The great moral questions of wealth and poverty in the world today involve huge, complex, structural political issues over which we may feel we have no influence if we can even begin to understand them. But we cannot ignore these issues. And this point came up a few years ago in quite a salutary way for us as a church in relation to the vote over a Swiss initiative about which we soon realized there were quite different views in this congregation. But I think, at least I hope, that from that process we all recognize that even if Christians don't agree, or will never agree, on every detail of the policies governments should adopt, we can agree on the following broad principle. I hope so, anyway. That principle is this, that in our thinking, our way of life, our voting, our investments, and other commitments we adopt, we should be guided by our Christian vision of the flourishing that God wills will be needed if all people are to be able to flourish and enjoy the good gifts God bestows generously on us all. And we are citizens, or as in my case, at least residents, of a wealthy nation. And we benefit from that hugely every day. Are we then taking seriously our responsibilities and our opportunities to promote God's ways of justice and compassion throughout the world? Moving from the large scale to the small scale, the fact that there are global political and economic questions about wealth and poverty doesn't mean that we can ignore the day-by-day micro-level challenges to live as faithful followers of Christ in relation to issues of wealth and poverty. Well, don't worry, I don't believe that our faith lays upon us a set of detailed rules, prescriptions, a blueprint instructing each of us how exactly to handle our wealth. I'm not going to lay that on you this morning. Christian guidance in this area of life has generally been expressed in terms not of specific rules, but rather of principles and attitudes of heart. Faithful Christian discipleship can take quite different forms. It can look like St. Francis embracing holy poverty. But it can also look like a gifted Christian entrepreneur running successful businesses, harnessing their potential for the common good, and doubtless along the way, having to wrestle with many temptations and hard questions. But even if there is no blueprint for Christian living in this area, there are challenges for us all. I'm going to conclude by highlighting some principles from today's reading from Paul's first letter to Timothy in our lives. First, the wealthy are told in this reading not to be haughty or arrogant. For Christians, wealth should lead not to arrogance, but to humility, to a sense of responsibility rather than of entitlement. Our attitude to whatever wealth we have should be to recognize humbly the great responsibilities it lays upon us. Because as Jesus says, of those to whom much has been given, much will be required. We must therefore humbly and regularly seek God's guidance for the use of our wealth. And we must also ponder the serious warnings in this reading about the dangers that wealth poses to us all, about which we can never be complacent. The pursuit of wealth, we read, traps people in senseless and harmful desires, plunging them into ruin and destruction. The love of money, we read, draws people away from faith in God and pierces them with many pains. Second, we are to set our hopes not on the uncertainty of riches, but we read, rather on God. There is something terribly insecure and uncertain about wealth. I dare say some of us have experienced that in the vicissitudes of life from time to time. It is right to make financial plans for the future, for our dependents. It may be wise even to pay a financial advisor to help us. But we do all this realizing that all such plans are provisional, uncertain, because money simply cannot give us the security we need, which ultimately comes only from God. So the question in the end is this: what really matters to me? What compels me? What is enthroned in my heart, God or wealth? Does God or wealth play the tune to which my life dances? Well, those two points are rather negative. They come as warnings. A third and final point that I'm going to end on is much more positive, because our faith offers us a distinct and very rich perspective on what it means to be truly wealthy. The rich are told to do good, to be rich in good works, generous, and ready to share. Note that phrase, rich in good works. Here is an attractive, outward-looking definition of what it means to be truly rich. This is the kind of wealth we can pursue without any danger. True wealth is not about what we can acquire, keep for ourselves, or just within our family, but about looking out towards others, giving out generously. True wealth is, in the end, like God's wealth. which is quite unlike the wealth of the grasping hoarder. God is rich in grace. God's wealth lies in giving. That is what it means to be truly rich. Think for a moment. If God were a rich hoarder, there would be nothing. Literally nothing. There would be no universe, no you and me, no love, just a black hole. But instead, the God who is rich in grace, generous and endlessly self-giving, gives himself in creating and loving the universe. All that we see, all the people and all the beauty we have known, it is all the outpouring of God's wealth. That is true wealth. And the good news is that it can find an echo in our lives if we also learn to give generously, to see our true prosperity in terms not of what we can call our own, but of what we can give out. To be rich in good works, to be rich in giving. According to the final words of this reading, to live like this is to take hold of the life that really is life. That is the kind of wealth we should aim for. May that be so in us. May God, who is rich in grace, transform our hearts and minds so that we may know abundance of life as we follow in the way of Jesus, who teaches us that it is more blessed to give than to receive.